This is VK6 Amateur Radio News for Sunday the 20th of December 2020. In case I forget to say it later, on behalf of the whole News West team, I wish you all a happy and safe Christmas. In today's News West, we're looking at the history of amateur radio, including an interview with Phil, the guy at the Space Museum in Carnarvon. We hear about the resumption of amateur radio in 1945. There's a radio story from Antarctica, and if you've ever wondered how the time pips were generated for broadcasts on 6WF way back when, we've got the story. Roy presents his weekly helpline, and there's some ham radio Christmas poetry. News West is your amateur radio news service for the VK6 call area and beyond. Available on air, online, and on demand. Visit vk6.net to find out how.
From the Telegraph newspaper, Brisbane, on Thursday the 27th of December 1945, is an article about a post-war Christmas present for amateurs. The heading reads, Amateur Radio Fans Get Transmission Licenses. Canberra, amateur radio operators received a Christmas present from the Postmaster General's Department on Christmas Eve when the first batch of licenses was issued authorising them to resume transmission. The first of the Australian amateur broadcasting stations to be heard since the outbreak of the war were on the air over the Christmas holidays, but operations were limited in some of the states by restrictions on the use of electricity. Before the war, thousands of owners of shortwave broadcast receivers obtained their greatest interest from eavesdropping on the amateur band, where conversations in unscrambled telephony could be heard from all parts of the world. Commercial radio telephone stations are unintelligible on broadcast receivers because the speech is scrambled for secrecy. Outside dual wave range, it will be some months before ordinary radio listeners are able to resume their old hobby of listening to amateur radio signals because wavelengths normally allotted to amateurs are at present outside the range of most dual-wave broadcast receivers. Most of the pre-war amateur wavelength bands are still being used by the fighting services, and amateur transmission on them will not be permitted until they are released sometime next year.
Commencing Christmas Eve and continuing through to New Year's Eve, slow scan TV images will be transmitted from the International Space Station via and as part of the About Gagarin from Space experiment. The broadcast is timed to coincide with the 20th anniversary of ARIS. Slow scan TV images will be transmitted at 145.800 MHz using a Kenwood TM-D710 transceiver. They are expected to use the PD120 SSTV format. So folks, that's a whole week of slow scan TV goodies from space. Have you tried receiving slow scan TV before? Well, here's a good start. 73s.
This is News West from VK6 ARN.
This article is in the West Australian, Perth, Wednesday, the 28th of January, 1948. It begins with the heading, Long Antarctic Radio Silence Ends. Pierce operator told of Heard Island adventures as a radio officer off duty at RAAF station. Pierce was making a routine check of all amateur sending stations. He heard a faint signal, radio VK3 ACD Antarctica. He replied, and then came the message, thank goodness we have made contact with Australia at last. The party of 14 Australian scientists at Heard Island had been completely isolated from civilization for nearly a month. The Antarctic operator, Mr. Scholes of Sydney, said that he'd been trying every day to make contact with Australia or a ship ever since the naval craft LST-3501 left the island on December 30. The reason for the faintness of the message, picked up late last week, was that he was operating a radio with only a 5-watt output, the size of a small attaché case. This was an amateur radio set that had been carried in case the other sets broke down. The powerful radio transmitters that the party had taken with them were not operating yet, and it was likely that there would be further considerable delay before necessary repairs were made to equipment which had been damaged in the rough landing on the island. One large power battery had been lost in the sea during the landing, and another was smashed when it was dropped 30 feet as mountainous waves lashed the ship. The Pierce operator, Flight Lieutenant Quentin Foster, said last night that he had been in touch with the island several times since he picked up the first message, and the members of the party had asked him to send telegrams to relatives that they were well. Radio messages he picked up yesterday and Monday said that the main aerials, which were massive affairs which were thought to be able to withstand any weather, had been blown down, and the task of setting up official radio contact with the mainland had been made even more difficult. He learnt that members of the expedition had succeeded in erecting several prefabricated huts, but these were not proving as cozy as a home as he had been thought, for sand and snow, churned to fury by the gales, blew in under the boards and swirled around them. The 14 men were snowed in on Sunday, with gales exceeding 100 miles per hour. But on Monday, Flight Lieutenant Foster learnt two of the party were out hunting seals with the objective of extracting oil to make soap. The medical officer, Dr. Alan Gilchrist of Melbourne, had found the weather too rough to use his motorcycle, the only machine on the island other than the bulldozer, which made the first landfall, except on rare occasions when he had explored around the new Australian settlement. After the more serious business of taking messages for relatives had been attended to, Flight Lieutenant Foster, he and Mr. Scholes, had found time for a few light-hearted observations on the comparisons in the weather at the two points 2,400 miles apart. At 11:45 Saturday night, when they were having one of their talks, Mr. Scholes said that it was still daylight down there, but he had better sign off as the boys were throwing a bit of a party. I'll write you a letter and you'll get it next Christmas, I hope. The expedition left Fremantle for Heard Island late in November, and it was expected that they would be away from Australia for about 15 months. There are two Western Australians in the party, Mr. George Compton of Kalgoorlie, a geologist, and Mr. S. Jones of Fremantle, the cook.
From the Daily News, Perth, Western Australia, Monday the 9th of February, 1931. This is a regular column called The Broadcaster by VK6 Fox Golf. The title of the article is Radio Time Signals, How It Is Done. There are several thousand listeners who set their household clocks and then personal watches by the time signals given from 6WF. While at sea, there are dozens of ships which nightly correct their chronometers by the time signal from the Applecross radio station, VIP. Many readers may be interested to know how it is all done. The source of the time signal is, of course, the Perth Observatory, facing Kings Park. Up there, set away as far as possible from any ground vibrations, is the master clock. Its dial doesn't convey much to the ordinary individual, but this is the clock which is checked by those infallible guides, the stars. Regularly, usually daily if weather conditions permit, observations are taken through the big telescope, and as known stars pass a hairline before the astronomer's eye, an electric key is pressed, and from this reading, the star clock is corrected. Not that the hands are pushed about, for the mechanism is rarely touched. Instead, the result of a few decimal sums is recorded. With the star clock corrected, it is a simple matter for the astronomer, still using an electric relay to convert star time into Greenwich Mean Time, and from that to Perth time. The star clock is remarkably regular, but to an astronomer, a hundredth part of a second is a weighty matter, and causes the mathematics that would break the ordinary schoolboy's heart. A telephone line connects the observatory with the broadcasting studio, and at certain times of the day, a switch is closed, which brings the line into operation, and when the hour is reached, a relay works which rings a bell at the studio. The sound is picked up by the microphone and passed out into the ether to travel to listeners at the rate of 186,500 miles a second. It must be admitted that the listener 500 miles away hears the sound a little later than the city listener, but as it only amounts to a minute fraction of a second, it is not likely that the countryman will claim this as one of the disadvantages of living in the agricultural areas. Of course, the broadcast of the town hall clock is a different matter altogether. The time service to shipping is arranged in another way. Automatically operated by a relay, a large drum bearing a number of notches commences to rotate 3 minutes before 9 a.m. Connected to this revolving drum is another telephone line to Applecross, and the notches on the drum spell the letters ONOGO in the Morse code. The speed of the drum is so controlled that it takes exactly 3 minutes for the letters to be transmitted, so that the last Morse dash of the final O indicates accurately the stroke of 9 p.m. Perth time. One can visualise operators at sea following the signal closely so that the ship's time, so essential in working out bearings, will be correct to a split second. It is easily imagined what a boon these time signals are to those on the outskirts of civilization, who, before the advent of wireless, had no means of checking the time from one weekend to another. The city man need no longer miss his train, the busy housewife her tram, the watchmaker can set his customers' timepieces, and the factory whistle can blow on the stroke of the hour. In fact, it is only when we think on the subject that we realise how much man is a slave to the old father time.
Hi, this is Dan, VK6NAD. This interview was recorded several weeks ago with Phil Yude of the Carnarvon Space and Technology Museum.
I guess I always look at things that I'm always trying to think, okay, a museum to me can be very boring. A friend of mine, he used to work at SciTech in Perth, and that's where I've sort of looked at that thinking, okay, how can I, with next to no money, do the same sort of thing? And they are very sciencey and all the rest of it, but I've also got to think, well, hang on, I've got to try and keep everything a bit spacey. So how can I achieve the same sort of result with next to no money? And that's, I've been lucky that over the years, that's what I've been able to do.
How long's the museum been up and running now?
We opened in 2012. It was about between 6 and 8 months prep before that. And we had Buzz Aldrin come out and open the first museum. And I often think back, thinking how embarrassing was that the, we get Buzz Aldrin coming out here to open this tiny, tiny little museum in Carnarvon. The whole idea of getting him to come in the first place was that it was a snowball effect. So it put a focus on what we were trying to do and trying to put Carnarvon on the map for the right reasons. And I guess it did.
Now, Buzz has got more than a passing connection. Can you tell us a little bit about that? This is not just a collection of space items for interest's sakes. There's a little bit of history to the site.
The history relates directly to the Gemini, Apollo and Skylab programs that NASA were running. And the actual museum where we're housed now was the Overseas Telecommunications Commission site, which eventually evolved into Telstra. But just up the road from where the museum site is, there was a NASA tracking station. So that tracking station was in contact with the astronauts and did, it was the largest one outside the US. So it did actually form a rather large part of the whole makeup. And keep in mind that in those days, and that we're talking like the early 60s and into the early 70s, that satellites were very new. And that's why nowadays there isn't hardly any of these tracking stations around, because satellites have taken over from them. Whereas in those days, you actually had people on the ground and you had their satellite dishes pointed up to the spacecraft, and you were actually communicating directly with the spacecraft and relaying things on, relaying all the data and everything on. So that's the reason for a tracking station in the beginning, whereas nowadays they're a bit obsolete because of the satellites, which unfortunately that's technology, but it's in Carnarvon played an integral role.
So, Phil, there's a little bit of specific history with that site as well. With Apollo 11, I believe. You've got a very famous dish.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. At our museum, we've got two dishes there. One's a 30-metre one, which everyone seems to think, oh, that's the dish. But that dish was built and actually came into operation just after they landed on the moon. And that the reason for that was because of the communications between Australia and back to NASA was a bit dodgy, you know, at best, you know, using telephone lines and those sorts of things. So they built this dish for that specific reason, to go direct back to the States. But the other dish, which everyone seems to forget about, is people call it a sugar scoop, and you know, it's called a Cass horn. And that Cass horn was actually used by OTC to track rockets in the early days, putting satellites up. But also, as I said, in the early days of satellites, not everything went to plan. And one of the things that went to plan, or didn't go to plan, was that they launched this satellite and it didn't quite get into the right orbit. So what happened was all the technical boffins said, hang on, we could actually use this as a trial. We can see if we can get a TV broadcast out of Carnarvon to the UK. And this would be the first time it was done. So they actually used the dodgy satellite, and they had this 20-minute window on this particular day where they could use it to broadcast. And that was the first time it was used to broadcast TV out of Australia. And you think, out of Australia? Yes, out of Australia to the UK, came from Carnarvon.
In fact, some of the people that spoke on that first broadcast, I believe that was the very first time they'd seen the faces of their loved ones in real time since they'd emigrated from the UK.
That's right, because, you know, I've heard from a few people over the years that, you know, they jumped on the ship and said, see you, Mum, I'm off to Australia to go and work in the space industry. And Mum's saying, "Yup, what?" You know, and it's quite true. You know, they've gone off and they've come to Australia, which in those days, your Carnarvon and was in the middle of nowhere. And this was the first time, and you can see we have a copy of the broadcast playing in the museum, and part of that was come out here, they've married some girls, some of them even had babies, so then, you know, the first time they get to see their grandchild was on that TV program.
That's phenomenal. I believe the Cass horn also was used or had some role in the Apollo 11 mission.
Yeah, that was used in those days for the actual relay of the TV broadcast to Perth. So it relayed it back from Moree across to here and then down through the lines and everything back down to Perth. So keep in mind that nowadays they've got Nangara, which is a big Telstra satellite earth station, whereas in those days there was no Nangara, it was actually Carnarvon. So that's how all those programs got to Perth.
Now, talking about the big dish, there's a bit of controversy at the moment. The local shire doesn't have the funds. There's even been some rumours that they would rather pull it down than have it become derelict. And, of course, we as amateurs, that's horrific. And I believe it's heritage listed as well. What's the future for that big dish? Because certainly as you come into Carnarvon, it's one of the most prominent features you would see.
At the moment, the future is a bit mixed, but I would like to think that the federal government and the state government do actually protect it and provide some funding so we can actually not so much upgrade it but protect it so it's there for a lot longer than just the next few years. So it does need some money or maintenance. I don't think our wish is too much, but we're talking like $2 million to protect it. Which will keep it going probably for another 20 years or, you know, but it just needs to be got to a point where it's fixed up so the thing is not a rusting apart, then protected, and then, you know, it's ongoing maintenance, whereas realistically it's had none in 40 years. So it does need a little bit just to you know, get it back on track so it can still be an icon for the town and for Australia.
If somebody was to come and plug a radio into it, what would it actually take to get a little bit of movement out of it? Is it possible it could be used at all?
I'm not an engineer, so perhaps someone out there that is an engineer can come and tell us what the problem is. It can tilt up and down. It's not overly accurate, but at the moment it can't spin. So if you wanted to follow the moon, for example, it can't track the moon for that reason. And the reason, well, it's twofold. When it was decommissioned by Telecom in those days, all the parts went to another dish in Ceduna, and that they still have parts from Carnarvon sitting in their storeroom over there, still in wooden crates and all the rest of it. But we visited them about a year ago, and the technology has changed a lot over the years. So to actually get it to move again, the cost to actually buy the motors and do that side of it is not overly a lot. It's the maintenance, and has it gone too far? The rust on the bearings and all those sorts of things, has it gone too far that it's not repairable? Well, we don't know, but we would like to think, yes, we can make it move again. But once again, we don't have the expertise to be able to actually, you know, make that call at the moment.
My suggestion would be that if there was some amateur activity around these dishes, around this site, and let me go as far as to say we have in the past contacted NASA. We have organised events with school children, etc., and had people chatting with an astronaut. If it was possible to use something like the Cashorn, which I believe is probably more serviceable, and have an event, not only would it be great for Carnarvon, it'd be great for WA, but could we shine a light and maybe help get some funding and get these beautiful old antennas at least some level of protection and preservation? So there's a challenge there for people out there who work in this area or have an interest in EME. What can we do to protect this piece of heritage before it's gone? Thanks, Phil. And a little birdie tells me you might be joining us in the ranks of amateur radio shortly.
Well, I have set my exam and I did pass. So, yes, I'll be VK6 Yankee Oscar Bravo.
Oh, very good. I look forward to hearing that call sign on the callbacks for the news. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate the interview. This is VK6NAD.
This is VK6 Amateur Radio News, VK6ARN. In News West next week, we're going to tell you who's gained a new licence or a new call sign because it's the new Amateurs Edition. In this edition, apart from acknowledging and welcoming those who have entered the hobby or have achieved a milestone in their amateur radio journey, we'll talk about things that may interest newcomers, and who knows, there might even be some useful advice on offer. And I'll tell you what, wouldn't it be great if you sent in your own story on becoming an amateur, whether it was last month or last century? If you're not sure how to go about it, send an email to newswest@vk6.net and we can talk about how your story can make it to the news program.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through 2 meters, not a signal was keying up any repeaters. The antennas reached up from the tower quite high to catch the weak signals that bounced from the sky. The children, technicians, took their HTs to bed and dreamed of the day they'd be extras instead. Mom put on her headphones, I plugged in the key, and we tuned 40 meters for that rare ZK3. When the meter was pegged by a signal with power, it smoked a small diode and, I swear, shook the tower. Mom yanked off her phones and, with all she could muster, logged a spot of that signal on the DX packet cluster. Well, I ran to the window and peered up at the sky to see what could generate RF that high. It was way in the distance, but the moon made it gleam. A flying sleigh with an 8-element beam. And a little old driver, who looked slightly mean, so I thought for a moment that it might be Wayne Green. But no, it was Santa, the Santa of hams, on a mission this Christmas to clean up the bands. He circled the tower, then stopped in his track, and he slid down the coax right into the shack. While Mom and I hid behind stacks of CQ, this Santa of hamming knew just what to do. He cleared off the shack desk of paper and parts and filled out all my late QSLs for a start. He ran copper braid, took a steel rod, and pounded it into the earth till the station was grounded. He tightened loose fittings, re-soldered connections, cranked down modulation, installed lightning protection. He neutralized tubes in my linear amp. Never worked right before, now it works like a champ. A new low-pass filter cleaned up the TV. He corrected the settings in my TNC. He repaired the computer that wouldn't compute, and he backed up the hard drive and got it to boot. Then he reached really deep in the bag that he brought. And he pulled out a big box. A new rig, I thought. A new Kenwood? An ICOM? A Yaesu? For me? An Alacraft, Tentec, or Flex? Could it be? If he thought I'd been bad, it might be QRP. Yes, the ultimate station. How could I deserve this? Could be all those weekends I worked public service. He hooked it all up, and in record time, quickly worked 100 countries, all down on 160. I should have been happy. It was my call he sent, but the cards and the postage will cost a month's rent. He made final adjustments and left a card by the key. To Gary, from Santa Claus, 73. Then he grabbed his HT, looked me straight in the eye, punched a code in the pad, and was gone. No goodbye. I ran back to the station, and the pileup was big, but a card from St. Nick would be worth my new rig. Oh, too late, for his final came over the air. It was copied all over. It was heard everywhere. The ham Santa exclaimed what an old ham expects. Merry Christmas to all, and to all. Good DX.
The Ham's Night Before Christmas item that you just heard was narrated by KN4AQ, Gary. We've all heard this piece narrated by lots of people over the years. However, what's special about today's rendition is that Gary is the author of Ham's Night Before Christmas, which he composed back in 1996. And you can hear Gary's story about the poem on his vlog at hamradionow.tv. Gary kindly granted permission to NewsWest to put his audio to air in our news program. Thanks, Gary. The ACMA's Engage newsletter, distributed on Friday, advises of the current review of the 2.3 GHz spectrum licensing technical framework. The Radio Communications License Conditions Amateur License Determination 2015, which we call the LCD, authorises the operation of amateur services in the 2300 to 2302 MHz band. These amateur services operate on a secondary basis, which means amateur services must not cause interference to, and are not afforded protection from, services operated under a 2.3 GHz band spectrum licence. Despite this, amateur services are provided a level of coexistence by the 2.3 GHz unwanted emission limits defined. The ACMA said it's not expected that the proposed changes to the 2.3 GHz unwanted emission limits will have a significant impact on amateur operations in the 2300 to 2302 MHz band. Having said this, I'd encourage our listeners to review the documents and to make a submission if they feel a need to do so.
Greetings once again, listeners. Helpline 2020 for the 20th of December. Christmas is upon us. All stand by for Christmas present. And today we have Christmas presents from Kim, radio estate from Merv, VK6 Charlie Bravo, sadly Silent Key from Albany. He has the following valves: 807 brand new, 4 in wax boxes available. There's also 813 valves used, there's 2 of those available. 833 used twin triodes times 1. There's also a linear amplifier, a Hotel Lima 200 Bravo, an HL200 Bravo 12 volt 200 watt PEP, a UHF 12 volt linear amplifier, Kilo Lima Bravo 450. Inverters, a 600 watt inverter, 12 volts to 240 volt sine wave inverter. We have a power supply unit, a large 13.8 volt 25 amp homebrew power supply available, and hardware. There's an AR7 receiver, a vernier gearbox only I believe for an AR7 receiver. There's also transceiver, Kodan SRX NGT with a 9350 auto-tune antenna. Amateur option, GPS option included. If you're interested in any of those items, those valves through linears and transceiver, please contact Kim, VK6 Tango, Quebec. His phone number, 0427-983-329. 0427-983-329. Or email vk6tangoquebec@westnet.com.au. vk6tangoquebec@westnet.com.au. Next, I had a request for the whereabouts of the valve bank. It is presently with Rick, VK6 Quebec Tango. He has the valve bank from passed from Ron, VK6QB, Silent Key now. And any vacuum tubes you may have or would like to donate to the valve bank, or if you're looking for anything in particular, please contact Rick Hill, VK6 X-ray Tango, on 0468 425 099. Again, 0468 425 099 for the valve bank. That's all I have for this week. If you have any items for next week's broadcast, please contact me, VK6XRayVictor@bigpond.com. Victor Kilo 6XRayVictor@bigpond.com. Merry Christmas.
Well, ho, 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 and all that stuff. Next week's News West should arrive just as you're emerging from your food coma, and we'll be looking at the lot of the new amateur. The important things to remember for Christmas is to connect with family and friends, to take a break from the humdrum, and to enjoy the season. Thanks to the team this week, Mike, Jeff and Dan, and thanks to the broadcasters and callback collectors and everyone else who contributes to News West in one way or another. I'm Bob VK6POP, the News West producer. Do you want my job for Christmas? It's still up for grabs. I'll even gift wrap it for you. And whatever you do, don't neglect the airwaves at Christmas. Just lately the bands have been throwing up some surprises, so get on air and make some ho-ho-ho noise.